Well, I'd like to thank the conference organizers, especially David Bates, for asking me to give this presentation, and thanks to you for coming. What follows are some reflections prompted by my experiences over the past decade as an academic historian working at the University of the West of England in liaison with the wider public. I've worked with Bristol City Museum, with the archives, with the Empire and Commonwealth Museum on the history of slavery and its legacy. I'm leading the Academic Advisory Board for the new Museum of Bristol, which is due to open in 2009, and I'm also one of the project leaders for the England's Passport Everyone initiative, which, as you know, is a lottery-funded initiative under the DCH. And the project for Bristol is very ambitious, the history of ethnic minorities in Bristol and their impact on civic identity from the year 1000 to the year 2001. My other more marginal involvement has been with interfaith work and Holocaust commemoration. Now, my initial aim was to consider some of the tensions between rigorous critical history and public accessibility in general, and I am going to continue with that. And the three principles that I, the three areas I, and themes that I want to come back to are these, and I'll put them in an alliterative way so it's easier to remember, the perils of postmodernism, public memory and critical history, and the importance of a post-colonial analysis of the migration history. Now, whilst writing this paper, which I rather arrogantly thought, well, I've been so steeped in all this, it'll be easy to write, and I've spent days trying to get it down to the size it should be. And I came again and again to the issue of Holocaust commemoration, which I want to start with. And I hope what follows, though somewhat anecdotal, will prove of interest to you as educators and policymakers, because in this case, indeed, history really does matter. I've done some work in giving talks to school children. I was docent at the Anne Frank exhibition years ago, and I've done work with the wider public on Holocaust Memorial Day in Bath and Bristol. I've been repeatedly roped in at the last minute by civic authorities to speak because no one else had the time or inclination to do so. It's a young hospital nurse who really made me do it. Some years ago, my then landlady, an elegant descendant of an old English sugar merchant family, was hospitalized for cancer, and her husband, a famous architect, was constantly at her bedside. They were, for reasons which still aren't entirely clear, discussing the Nazi concentration camps. And as they spoke, the young nurse was making up a nearby bed and listened attentively. "Who's Auschwitz?" she asked. The Lubeckians were appalled. Only after their deaths did it emerge that, these architects, that Mr. Lubeckian, the Marxist firebrand, modernist pioneer, and reclusive post-war pig farmer, was not the rebellious son of a Moscow aristocrat, as he had claimed to be, but a Polish Jew who had kept secret his family background, even as his parents perished in the Warsaw Ghetto. The psychological destructiveness of genocidal hatred can strike deep indeed. Before his death, Lubeckian showed me the first pages of what he called his samizdat, his personal memoirs. You know, samizdat was the Russian sort of secret memoirs under the Soviets by dissidents. I read only the beginning, in which he told the story of how his aristocratic uncle had allowed a young Jew escape a pogrom by hiding in his walled garden in Moscow. This samizdat has since disappeared. It's been stolen, and so far as I know, it has never been recovered. But with hindsight, it struck me that Lubeckian was far more likely to have been the young Jew in the garden than the nephew of the beneficent and lordly uncle. His elaborate fabrications, born of a combination of internalized racialism and a rigid ideology that looked only to class, have haunted me ever since, and so too has the ignorance of the young nurse. In one recent poll of young British people's understanding of the Holocaust, it was found that a third of those surveyed were ignorant of what the term actually denoted, and that many of those who did know the term felt its significance and extent had been exaggerated. Despite, or perhaps because of the vast literature on the Holocaust, despite the funding of commemorative museums, despite the fact that the Nazi era is done to death in the school's history curriculum, the political climate around Holocaust studies has changed profoundly in the last decade. This is due in part to widespread discontent with Israeli foreign policy and the alleged conflation of the Holocaust with the Zionist agenda. The Irving trial and more recent conferences in Iran and Egypt are cases in point. It is partly due, too, to the dying off of the last eyewitness survivors to the Holocaust and the passage of time generally. Another factor in this changing climate is one documented by Richard Evans, the spread of moral relativism, that stepchild of postmodernism. This has helped to cast doubt in many young people's minds whether such a thing as the Holocaust has actually happened, and if so, whether one would ever be able to condemn it. 2 years ago now, one of my seminars, a sincere and well-meaning young woman said that the Nazis were like any other group, entitled to their own point of view, since no one had the right to repudiate any group's morality. Her remarks did not excite much opposition from her fellow students. A few years before that, a Bristol school pupil told me that her history class had gone to a sixth-form conference in Oxford, where the evidence for and against the existence of a plan to exterminate European Jewry was thoroughly rehearsed that she was no longer sure there was any such thing. The recent murder in Istanbul of the Turkish-Armenian journalist Hrant Dink reminds us of how difficult the problem of gathering conclusive evidence for genocide can be. And in the case of the Holocaust, there is a real problem in conclusively documenting the full number of victims when so much evidence was willfully destroyed. Right-wing and neo-Nazi groups have been quick to question the figure of 6 million, claiming that most of the deaths that were there were due to typhus rather than premeditated murder. But the passage of Holocaust denial offenses in Austria and elsewhere as a way of keeping a lid on neo-Nazi propaganda may make martyrs of those who are in prison. The German television series of some years back, Heimat, nicely illustrated the vested financial interests at stake, which colluded in the suppression of evidence, as more recent news stories about Holocaust gold kept in Swiss banks or the restitution of Klimt's famous picture, The Kiss, to its original Jewish owners has shown. Yet for all that, the defensiveness of many Jewish agencies regarding any questioning of the Holocaust, along with an unwillingness to criticize Israel, has fueled public suspicion, particularly amongst those most alienated by the hegemony of the West, that the Holocaust might, after all, be a put-up job. It is beyond the scope of this paper to analyze the debates over the existence of the Holocaust, the word itself a product of emotive judgment. We do not have the time to discuss the origins of its framing, but it is worth noting here that there appears to be a shift in language as well when the Holocaust is being discussed. In more liberal circles, amid widespread concern about the justice of the Iraq war and anxiety about al-Qaeda, attitudes to the Holocaust are informed by concern about Palestinian suffering and the dangers which the explosive situation in the Middle East poses to us all. With that in mind, some left-wing as well as radical Islamist groups have posited a moral equivalency between Nazi extermination policies and current Israeli mistreatment of the Palestinians. So teaching about the Holocaust has become a political minefield. The answer, some would say, is in the careful and reflective sifting of evidence and the precise use of language. But such a scholastic approach, though admirable, and of course something that as an academic historian I would advocate, will not win the interest of most school pupils who, as we have seen, do not even have a basic narrative understanding of the phenomenon known as the Holocaust. I have no magic bullets to offer you. What I would suggest is first, that when the Holocaust is discussed, that teachers focus not solely on the destruction of a reified and undifferentiated victim, but to look to inform students a little more about the diversity and multiplicity of Eastern European Jewry before the Nazis. Jews had lived in Poland and Germany for 800 years, and when one considers that fully one-third of Poland's bustling pre-war capital, Warsaw, a city of over 1 million people, was Jewish, and that this population of Jews, religious, non-religious, rich and poor, middling, socialist, reactionary, Zionist, anti-Zionists, idealists, cynics, secretaries, butchers, teachers, shopkeepers, violinists, poor shoemakers and rich jewelers, respectable dentists and rough peddlers, nurses, crooks, singers, and scribes, and that this community vanished, one begins to get a purchase on what happened in one city alone. The fact that one-third of Warsaw's doctors were Jewish reminds one that professional status is no guarantor of political safety. If one thinks that Anne Frank, usually trotted out as a sort of symbol, the icon of the Holocaust, the comfortably off daughter of a German banker who went to a Montessori school and had non-Jewish friends, was hunted down with the same alacrity and precision as an impoverished rabbi in a remote Ukrainian village, a peasant farmer in the Carpathian Mountains, or a struggling artist on the left bank, one begins to get a grasp of the diversity of the population and a glimpse of the barbarity and the enormity of the Nazi project. And one begins to understand, too, how genocidal hatred might be applied in other contexts. Many of the themes implicit in Nazi anti-Semitism have much older roots. And so my second point, the first being talking about Jewish history and not just the Holocaust, is that the history of anti-Semitism needs to be integrated into any treatment of the history of racism today. And I think too often it is not. The image of the Jew as the Christ killer was only recently repudiated by the Pope and is still to be found on the Internet. The related belief that Jews ritually assault and kill children to use their blood in religious ritual dates back to medieval times and was implicit in the image of both Svengali and the Nazi representations of Jews as murderous vampiric figures. The image of rich Jews secretly conspiring to control the world was a mainstay of Nazi propaganda that goes back to 19th century Russian forgery, Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is still widely published and distributed today. The specter of the poor Jew as a filthy criminal and disease-ridden other was another Nazi theme, which of course echoes in current tabloid representations of asylum seekers. Jews were decried both as capitalists and as Bolsheviks. The charge that Jews were naturally disposed to be moneylenders like Shylock dates, as we know, back to the Middle Ages, when they were barred from most occupations but allowed to lend money since usury was not lawful for Christians. And I think that's something that needs unpacking today, particularly in relation to Islam's continuing strictures about money lending and interest. When visiting a local mosque recently, I was asked, what was the Jew's secret? Why, the imam asked, are you all so rich and we are still taxi drivers? That was from the elders. The young people did not attend. The conspiracy discourse needs to be replaced with a more historicized one. It was occupational discrimination added to the high rates of Jewish literacy and the way Jews around the world could communicate and do business with one another in a common language, which explains why Jews were so overrepresented in the liberal professions and business and white-collar work compared to others in what was then a largely agricultural and semi-literate Eastern Europe. How tragically ironic it is that one of the tenets of early Zionism was that if Jews could only farm their own land and have their own nation, they would no longer be ghettoized in such parasitic occupations, and they could become a normal rather than a pariah nation. The third thing I would stress is that the attractiveness of Nazism needs to be acknowledged. The attractiveness of the social programs, the seductiveness of the Nazi aesthetic, and the very real sufferings of the Germans under Allied bombing campaigns. These also need to be integrated into any narrative around the Holocaust and its legacy. The beautiful athletic blonde so immortalized in Leni Riefenstahl's films set a standard of beauty that still dominates Western culture and is unthinkingly reproduced and replicated along with tropes gleaned straight from the legacies of black slavery into pop videos today. We use the term body fascism unthinkingly, but unpacking it historically might prove to be of interest and value to adolescents. There has been some excellent work done, especially by James E. Young, The Textures of Memory, on Holocaust commemoration today. It strikes me that history certainly matters here for museum policy as well as curriculum development. If we go to Germany, as I did for one Holocaust Memorial Day, I went to Hanover. And in the city hall, there are three models of the city in glass cases, showing the medieval city, the second case shows the city in 1938, and the third shows the city after its devastation under Allied bombing. These are enormously popular exhibits, and it struck me that the destruction of the synagogue during Kristallnacht in 1938, which is portrayed in the second case, could only strike the casual visitor as a minor irrelevance compared with the widespread destruction of the city shown in the third case. Also, in the city's museum, 800 years of the Jewish presence of the city was represented by part of one text panel in which a politically correct reference was made to an anti-Semitic riot in 1925. That silence was far more eloquent about surviving attitudes to genocide than the Stalinist monument to Holocaust victims in the city center. Now, I know teachers, because I'm married to one, always like to have some practical sort of things that they can use. And so I'd like to just take a... How much time do I have, guys?
About 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Well, we're going to have to talk about some of the other stuff in questioning. I'd like to tell you about a film called Paperclips, which offers some additional insights into the way Holocaust commemoration might be accommodated. It's directed in America by Elliot Berlin, and it was made in 2005. And it relates the actual experiences of Holocaust education project in an American school. The school's a middle school in a tiny rural community of Whitwell, Tennessee. Has anyone seen this film, by the way? No. It's a former coal mining area whose economy was in a state of near-terminal decline at the time of the film's making. The inhabitants of Whitwell, in the words of the charismatic head teacher, are now poor but not depressed. You know, the area is depressed, but they said they're poor, they're not depressed. The community is almost entirely white and Protestant. It lies less than 100 miles from one of the early centers of the Ku Klux Klan. The project began in 1998 when a small coterie of teachers launched an initiative to teach tolerance and diversity to their pupils. The teachers themselves didn't know much about the Holocaust, and it was one of their pupils surfing the internet who learned that the Norwegians under Nazi occupation had worn paper clips on their lapels as emblems of defiance against the Germans and of solidarity with the Jewish population. As Whitwell's pupils expressed difficulty in conceptualizing the idea of 6 million people being killed by the Nazis, the teachers asked them to solicit and to collect 6 million paper clips, one for each Jew who died in the Holocaust. The pupils began to write letters, but progress was slow until the Schroeders, a non-Jewish middle-aged German couple who worked in Washington, D.C. as White House journalists, got wind of the project and decided to get involved. They visited the school and subsequently publicized the pupils' quest in America, Germany, and beyond. The project mushroomed. Paper clips poured in from all over the world, many with personal testimonials about the Holocaust. A group of New York Jews in their 80s traveled to Whitwell to talk about their experiences as Holocaust survivors, and rather tellingly were invited to speak from the pulpit of the local Methodist church alongside a large cross. In the end, 24 million paper clips were sent to the school. It was decided to store them in some sort of museum, along with the letters and artifacts that had also been accumulated. The Schroeders traveled to Germany, found one of the few remaining cattle cars of the type used to transport people to the camps, and they arranged to have the car brought all the way to Tennessee, where the citizens of Whitwell converted it into a resting place for all those paper clips, and as a memorial to Holocaust victims, but also to all those other victims of genocide. The film, produced by two well-known Jewish producers, the Weinstein brothers, might be termed a feel-good movie. It was both moving and frustrating. So many questions had not been asked. Was there really such unanimity in the majority community about the project and what was, after all, Klan territory? Why weren't the town's few African-American pupils interviewed about how they felt about the project? An oblique reference was made about how the project got one of the teachers to question his own upbringing, based on rigid gender roles, racialist attitudes, and harsh discipline. I would have liked to have heard more about that. Tolerance of homosexuals was mentioned because, obviously, homosexuals and leftists and Roma and Jehovah's Witnesses were also mentioned as victims of the Holocaust. But what discussions have the toleration of homosexuality engendered in and out of the classroom? How had this close-knit fundamentalist evangelical community, whose religious ideology is intrinsically proselytizing, coped with their secular and Orthodox Jewish visitors? I think these are questions that could, you know, generate very good discussion with that film. And though some reference was made to other victims of the Nazis, the Holocaust was routinely characterized as exclusively directed against the Jews and as an unproblematic given. As admirable as the film was in many ways, and I do commend it to teachers, I think its treatment needs to be critically aware. Now, in the 2 minutes I have remaining, I'll get to all the other things I have to talk about. I've done a lot of work on slavery and abolition, and the principle I would like to just drive home is that there is a difference between popular memory and critical history, and that the needs, particularly of black parents, to have role models for their kids to whom their children can relate isn't served by having a history that is exclusively directed on slavery and black people as victims. On the other hand, it is a very difficult to critically treat slavery without talking about very traumatic and difficult topics. And so I think, A, the history of slavery needs to be integrated with the history of colonialism, a point I'll come back to in a minute. But also that there's in a sort of postmodernist sort of climate, it's very easy to perhaps turn to African history with a K and to uncritical celebrations of Egyptian histories and black kings and queens. And I really do urge caution, because I think some of this history is not backed up by the evidence. And I think it's a difficult one, a difficult road to hoe. Those of you who would be interested, is one of the more positive things that Bristol Black Archive Project has done, which is a consortium of black activists, the museums, the university, and the archive, is to get some home office funding for a collection policy for African Caribbean migrants, but also to produce a calendar which looks at both local Bristol worthies from the African Caribbean community, but also the documents we have from the days of slavery and beyond. And if anyone would like a copy, I'll bring some in at lunchtime and leave them on the desk. But I think it's a good project and a way forward for other localities to do. The final thing I will say, and I do apologize for running out of time, is the importance of a post-colonial analysis when talking about migration history. The work I've done for EPI on the 20th century migration was followed through from work I did on 18th and 19th century black presence in Bristol, which was both Caribbean and African American. And what really comes through loud and strong is you cannot understand police-migrant relationships in the 50s and 60s without understanding, A, the complete underdevelopment of Jamaica, the history of the Maroons and slave rebellion in Jamaica, the history of land riots from Morant Bay in 1865 to the trade union riots of the late 1930s that produced a particular culture, particularly pronounced in Jamaica. And then you have to also understand that the police, and we've found new police records, many of them were brought up in the colonial service in the West Indies. So, you know, you've got to understand the kind of tensions in this context. And I think it really enriches our understanding of migration in that area. It also problematizes it because it raises some very difficult questions. So postmodernism, postcoloniality, and the difference between popular memory and critical history are the three messages and principles I've got across. Thank you very much.